This is the Bookmark Podcast from Scottish Book Trust. If you love books and reading, connect with us at scottishbooktrust.com, on Facebook, and on Twitter.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Bookmarked. I'm Ryan Van Winkle. We've got a fantastic episode. We've got four fascinating authors on the program, and we're dealing with places all over the world. We're going to Antarctica, and we're going to talk a little bit about penguins and solitude with Gavin Francis, a young writer named Sabrine Kadim from Iraq, as well as her Scottish-American counterpart, our friend Christelle Bamford. They were at the Erbil Literature Festival in Kurdistan just this month, so really exciting to present that to you. And we have our friend from Glasgow, Caro Ramsey, fantastic crime novelist and author of The Blood of Crows. We caught up with Caro in Glasgow. Here's a little excerpt from our conversation. Caro, maybe the best place to start for this podcast is to talk a little bit about The Blood of Crows.
Yeah, one of the good things about the fact that I still have a day job is that people do sometimes just say things that spark off an idea you would have never have got in any other way. And I was tweeting somebody who works for a very, very big public school or private school, and they were saying that some of their pupils come in and pay the sessional fees in cash. And that immediately gets you thinking, oh, what are the parents up to when they've got that much money to dispose of? And then you read that the Crays, the very famous gangsters from London, their children are now at very big public schools up in Scotland, you know, staying there, boarding. So you then just think, well, how much of that violence is in the DNA, and are they going to be respectable businessmen? And then what happens? And then, of course, you have the Russian gangsters coming into Glasgow, and that all just set off a lovely vision in my mind of what might be. There's a very famous Glasgow gangster called Arthur Thompson, who, like the Crays, has a reputation that he was always very nice to his mother and very nice to people that lived in his own street. And he still lived in a big council estate even the day he died. And there was he had bought up four or five houses in the row, but the little old lady that lived in the middle didn't want to move. So the family used to walk around the front and the back garden, not to annoy her. You know, and she stayed there till the day she died, and she was kind of protected, basically being surrounded by the Glasgow mafia, if you like. So then when you think about, you know, the Russians coming in and the police characters that I write about, the police characters then have a decision to make, you know, and the book's all about, are you better with the devil you know than the devil you don't? Because sometimes the only person that can bring down a gangster regime like that is another bunch of gangsters. So that's what the book's about.
Your two protagonists are these...
Anderson is your quiet, sort of thinking intellectual cop, and Costello's just a female who just wants to go about punching people. I don't know where I get her character from at all.
Do you, not that you want to punch people, you stab people in your occupation, right?
Yes, but I do it with their permission and with very small needles. I'm an acupuncturist, so that's fine. But the serious point about that is that diagnosis and detective work is the same thing. You know, you start off with a list of clues and hopefully you get to an end. So that process of thinking is there. The great thing about being a female and writing about a female character is that you can make her do anything. You can make her eat lots of chocolate and she never puts weight on. You know, she will get up in the morning and run 6 miles. You know, and then she just goes about just hitting people when it suits her. And, you know, people do email you and they, you know, they go onto the webpage and leave you. And the one thing that they loved was when she decked, which is Glaswegian for, you know, sticking one on them and the other guy hits the floor, when she decked the other cop who was he's very, very well dressed and just gets everything right, and he's just so annoying that she just thumps him. There was a round of applause as the blood spread over his designer shirt.
What do you start with The Blood of Crows? Was it just that spark of the idea of somebody paying for cash for their thing, and that what that led on to this kind of curiosity of, like, you never know your own neighbor sort of thing? Or does it start with just wanting to put your protagonists in interesting situations, or is it a combination of those things?
I think writers have at the back of their mind just a wee sort of cell, a wee amoeba that just absorbs interesting ideas, and then it spits them out. And then when it spits out, you write it down, and then you just keep writing and writing and writing, and you find out that you think you're writing yourself into a corner, and then you find that the back of your brain has already got it sorted and it's not a corner at all. And the next book, The Night Hunter, I drafted that on a drive up to Inverness, sitting in the passenger seat of the car, it has to be said. But just within like an hour, I had the entire plot of the book, and it just happens, and then you've got to go and write it, otherwise you go a bit insane.
Can we have a little reading from The Blood of Crows?
This is the very start of The Blood of Crows. This is a prologue. Pauline McGregor walked quickly towards the lift. The smell of petrol and exhaust fumes was making her feel nauseous. She was getting too old for this subterfuge. Not only too old, she was too pregnant. 8 months now. It was exactly 9 weeks since she'd been able to button her coat. Exactly 7 weeks and 3 days since she'd last worn her stilettos. Was she going to be a bad mother? Probably. But at least she'd be a stylish one. She hated the red pumps she had on. They made her ankles look fat, and she could feel the cold of the concrete beneath her feet nibble the way through the soles. She pulled her scarf up to her neck. The forecast said it was going down to -5 tonight, but the chill and the wind that funnelled through the first level of the multi-storey car park promised an even colder night was on its way. She stopped at the lift doors and pressed the mangled button with a gloved finger, swaying from side to side as she waited, rocking the baby. The lift doors opened with a reluctant whine and she stepped forward, then back again, cupping her hand to her mouth as the stink of steel urine swept out to meet her. A discarded beanie hat lay in the corner, a syringe lying neatly on top of it. The mess that splattered the wall looked like a half-digested kebab. One advantage of her flat shoes was that she could take the stairs, but the door to the stairwell she heard voices higher up, hard, violent words answered by the sing-song anger of the drunk. She thought better of it and decided to walk up the narrow pavement that edged the spiralling exit at the centre of the car park. She shivered and placed a protective hand on her stomach. It was dark and cold, and the sooner she was in her car and out of here, the better. She knew she was parked on the second storey, on the side that faced down onto Mitchell Lane. Sound travelled far in the cold evening air. She could hear bursts of chit-chat from the pub in the street below, which echoed strangely off the bare walls. Her gloves patted their way along the wall, cashmere wool catching occasionally in the roughness of the concrete, and her breath billowed in front of her as she walked round a hairpin bend up to level two. Her back and legs were aching. She could hear fighting in the stairwell, then the slam of a door, a figure shot past the glass panel, followed by another slam, and a nearby car alarm started to shriek, then fell silent. For the first time she hesitated, feeling a vague prickle of apprehension that she was being watched. All noise had ceased now, the silence in here somehow separate from the sounds of life going on in the street. It was quiet, too quiet. She quickened her step, pulling the bone-handled knife from her handbag. She always carried it. It was part of her, a gift from her father. Then she heard a car door open on an upper floor, and she moved to the inside of the pavement in case the car came past her. She wasn't so quick on her feet these days. She could see her own Merc waiting for her in the far corner. Looking carefully left and right, she stepped off the pavement to make her way towards it. All the spaces between her and her car were full. She sensed him rather than heard him, and her grip on the knife tightened. He came out of the darkness between the two cars. There was a few seconds slow dance between them, then his blade went low and into her ribs like a hot knife through snow. Hers went high into his face. Neither of them made a sound. He raised his hand to stem the blood, a thick curtain of red pouring down his cheek into his scarf, and he walked off, making his unhurried way to the level above, leaving her to stagger against the bonnet of the car. She felt her knife slip from her fingers. She felt the baby kick, and then she sank to her knees on the ice-cold concrete. She punched the car on the left hard and kicked the one to her right, relieved at the cacophony of alarms. She curled up between the cars, her hand pressed to her wound. She watched the flow of her own blood spreading on the concrete, and she raged the betrayal. The baby kicked again, and she spread her fingers on her belly. Be calm, be calm. She was hidden from view. She realised if anyone came past, they wouldn't see her. So she scrabbled, her fingers scrabbled against the wheel arch, and she pushed her body a few inches so that her feet and her red shoes would be visible to anyone driving past. Would they see the red shoes in the blood? She tried again, another few inches, then fell exhausted out of breath. But nothing was happening. There was no air coming into her lungs. She felt her chest collapsing to nothing. The baby kicked and kicked again, demanding oxygen. She heard the shriek of a cold engine being gunned, the screech of tyres. A black car swung round the spiral, steering wide, then jerked left, aiming straight for her. She never felt the tyres go over her legs, crushing her ankles, ripping her shoes off. She only saw the raw ends of her own bones, kind of pink and beautiful. A billow of exhaust hung in the air as one blood-red shoe bounced and rolled and came to rest in a puddle of oil.
Oh, God, that's horrible. I want more.
It has to be horrible because your interest in finding out who did that has to sustain you for 400 pages. People say, oh, why are crime books so awful, and was it was a murder at the front? He said, well, you can't sustain 400 pages wanting a parking ticket sorted. You know, it just doesn't work.
Can you talk a little bit about how you started out writing? You had a horrible back injury and you started writing.
Didn't even know I could write. It all just came to me. But I'm a bit of a Buddhist, and I think that when things, weird things happen to you in life, they happen for a reason. I mean, I really have difficulty sitting on my backside for more than 2 minutes, so writing isn't a natural thing for me to do. But being incarcerated like that in hospital, the only thing I could do was write, so I did. And I wrote a quarter of a million words before I came out, and that turned into book one and two.
You went and were working with, yep, with the Johnston Writers Group.
Yep. When I first went to, because I had these quarter million words and I had no idea what to do with it, you know, and I wasn't back at my work and I was a wee bit bored. So I went along to the Johnston Writers Group, and in those days there was a writer in residence paid for by the council, and that was a girl called A.G. Close, who's a very well known, and a literary writer, you know, a proper writer. You know, I read out the first bit and everybody just sat there in stunned silence because it was just as violent as that bit I've written. And she said to him, did I see some more of that? And I said, yes. So I gave her it and she suggested a few changes and then said, you could send that off to Jane Gregory because she likes evil women like you, and she's the agent for Val McDermott and Mo Hader and Minette Walters and Martin Waits. And I said, oh, right, okay. And she signed me there and then. I don't know what Jane saw, but I think she saw somebody with a very raw talent. And then there followed 2.5-3 years of me rewriting that book 10 or 11 times because I really knew nothing. But having listened to agents and editors talking, in some ways it's quite nice to get someone that knows nothing, because you will then take a telling. But I am learning my craft well. I think you just get a different box of difficulties with writers, but I'm certainly not a writer that says, you know, that my work is precious and I'm not changing anything. You know, you're a craftsman and someone else comes along and almost tells you what to craft.
Yeah. Was that something that you had learned, you know, had expectations of or a taste of via the writing group as well?
The thing about a writer's group is you learn from other people's mistakes. You listen to things and you think, that's not right. And then you think, well, what would I do? How would I put that right? Which is why it's such a marvellous thing. And you do get inspiration. There was a bit in Absolution when I was trying to write a bit about just how beautiful this woman was, just capturing the art of her beauty, if you like. And then one of the nature poets in the writer's group just read out this poem he had about a girl just walking along a beach. And it immediately brought to mind that very famous picture of Marilyn Monroe on the beach in black and white when she's got no makeup on. And that was exactly what I was after. It just went, that's it. That's, you know, and I'd been struggling just to find the wee key just to turn that part of the novel and not make that girl sound like something she wasn't.
Right.
You know, so yeah, it's multi-inspirational. It's very good. And it's a very good laugh. You know, that's the other thing.
Yeah, it should be fun, right? Yeah. You have fun writing these things, don't you?
Oh, yeah. We have fun in the writer's group. We always stop for coffee and yes, it's great. You know, it's great when you hear an 84-year-old lady writing a sex scene. You know, that's marvellous.
Speaking of, congratulations on beating out 50 Shades of Grey.
Yeah,
I guess is an appropriate time to say that.
Yeah, it's my claim to fame. Normally it gets up like a standing applause when you say that. Well done. Well done, you.
Knocked it off the charts. Cara Ramsey, everybody. Go check out The Blood of Crows. Or if you want to find out more about Cara or see her in person, she's performing in April at the I Write Festival in Glasgow. Also, you can find her work on her own website, cararamsey.co.uk. Or she's been doing a blog for Murder Is Everywhere, the award-winning crime writing blog. Up next, slightly different tack, Gavin Francis is an author and a doctor who lives and works in Edinburgh, and he's from Fife, and he spent this incredible 14 months in the Antarctic, and he wrote a book about it. And the book is called Empire Antarctica, and it's been doing incredibly well. The reviews have been glowing, and people such as Paul Theroux and A.L. Kennedy have enthused about it massively. I think it's definitely going to be due for some serious awardage this season. And Gavin really kindly just sat down and talked to us a little bit about his experience, what it was like to be in the Antarctic for that long, and how important it is to make friends with the penguins. So, ladies and gentlemen, Gavin Francis.
So this is a book about my experience of living for 14 months in Antarctica on a research station, really, a very remote research station that's impossible to get in or out for 10 months of the year. And I went there to work for the British Antarctic Survey, about, you know, a few hundred miles from the South Pole, on a place quite near the coast where ships would come in December and then they couldn't get back in until the following November.
That's so far and so cold and so dark and so lonely. What made you want to do it?
Well, I was working as a doctor on the east coast of Africa in a little hospital a few years ago, and I had quite an intense experience working in the tropics. Good experiences, but also bad experiences. Too hot, lots of disease, quite overwhelming levels of poverty and corruption, difficult to deal with. As part of a sort of internal rebalancing, I suppose, I went to the Arctic, and I spent 5 months travelling around the Arctic because it seemed like the opposite in order to get some internal equilibrium back. And I think I just got the bug, really. It bit me, this bug of polar landscapes, the extraordinary simplicity of them, the beauty of the landscape around, and the freedom, really, of them. I couldn't rest until I saw the other end, the Antarctic end.
So what do you learn about yourself in this situation?
The wonderful thing about the Antarctic is it's unowned. It has no real political jurisdiction. It's an entirely empty landscape. Where I was, there was just flat ice shelf and sky and sea, which was frozen for most of the year. So there were no elements to the landscape other than light and ice and air. I was there as a doctor, but I had nothing to do. There was only a few other people on the base with me, and they were all young, fit and healthy. So you're in a place with almost no stimuli. It's really quite extraordinary in what it can do to your mind, because it means that you can really unfold a lot of things. You can unpack a lot of things about your past. You can unpack a lot of experiences, ambitions, regrets, and examine them all in a very undistracted way on one of the widest, blankest canvases on Earth. I think the solitude does provide extraordinary gifts there, really. I think in this world, when you look around you here, there's an awful lot of medium-sized objects. There's a lot of things that are about the same size as us, like cars, trees, bushes, rocks. You go somewhere like that, there's nothing the same size as us at all. It's just either very, very big, like auroral displays or meteorites or planets moving around you, or very, very small. It's just snow and frost and ice particles. And so the penguins are the only thing in that entire environment that are not only living, so remind you of that you're part of a community to living, but also are about the same size as you. Consequently, I think they gather a great deal of importance in your life. If they're the only thing that you can correspond with or commune with or spend time with that gives you any connection to your life back in the north when you're in Antarctica, it's penguins. And so I spent a lot of time with them.
What would you do with them?
I'd just hang out with them. Yeah, just walk about the colony. There were 60,000 of them during the summer. Just walk around and sit down, and they weren't afraid of you. They'd come and sit with you. And yeah, sometimes the little chicks are in trouble, they're going to get squashed by other adults, whatever, you help them out. And yeah, there's a lot you can do. It's amazing how you can put in a day in an emperor penguin colony, believe it or not.
Just briefly, doctor, but you're also doing the writing. How do those two worlds meet? Is it something that you're always thinking of, or is like doctoring time quite like just a different mode for you?
Yeah, for me, it's just a very different mode. It's what I was trained to do, and it's what I really love doing. I really enjoy it. It fulfills a different aspect of my personality, I guess. When I'm being a doctor, I all the time interacting with people, talking all day, and when I'm writing, I sit in silence for a day or so in the library, and I split my time fairly evenly between one and the other. And yeah, they both answer to different parts of me, I guess. Mm.
Does it enhance the writing? Do you think that that's a part?
I think that being a writer and attending to those sorts of, that level of attempting to communicate, attempting to describe situations and attempting to understand dynamics and then relate them on a page, I think it all helps your ability to be a compassionate doctor. And conversely, I think there are skills you learn being a doctor that are to do with time management, being concise, simultaneously interpreting a whole load of different streams of information, which help you be a good writer. So I think the two are complementary to a great extent.
So yeah, I mean, your book has been like well received by loads of super famous people like Paul Theroux and A.L. Kennedy. Paul Theroux says, "The embodiment of everything I admire in travel writing," which is a pretty good thing from Paul Theroux. And I was wondering if you could just share with us some of your top five inspirational books or travel books that you think you'd recommend our listeners to have a read of.
The kind of books I really admire are people that find original ways of describing situations. So one of my favourite books in terms of inspiration, I'm going through a lot of Annie Dillard at the moment. You know, Annie Dillard is a kind of considered very much an American nature writer. She wrote a Pulitzer Prize winning book called Pilgrim at Tinker Creek in the 70s, and she's done a lot of other books. She's an inspiration because she takes the everyday and she breaks it down and describes it in the most extraordinary poetic way. Probably no travel writer in Britain you could get to do this list without mentioning In Patagonia by Chatwin, Bruce Chatwin, just because it was a real game changer when it came out in the mid-70s. Yeah, it came out about the same time as Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. It transformed the way that people thought about books because they realised that actually, yeah, you don't need to stick to these genre rules. You can just chop and change, you can throw in stories, you put in a bit of fiction, you can take in some modern popular science, you can do what you like. So that was a real game changer. At the moment, I'm going down through a lot of Sven Lindqvist. He's a Swedish historian, essentially, that's just starting to get translated into English, and he's amazing. He wrote three books about colonialism in Africa while travelling through the Sahara. So Exterminate All the Brutes, Desert Divers. He's just got one come out called The Myth of Wu Daozu. The most concise, flinty prose that you can come up with, really packed with detail, beautifully balanced. Paul Theroux, I went through years of admiring Paul Theroux. That's why I wrote him and asked him if he would like my book, and I was so astonished that he did. But things like his novels, things like The Mosquito Coast, and his books like Old Patagonian Express. He also really blew the whole travel market wide open. And from just to stay on the theme of travel, I think probably my fifth, I'd have to go for Colin Thubron. He's an old master of travel writing. He wrote his first book was about Lebanon, I think, in the 60s. And he did one about Jerusalem during the Six-Day War. And he's still writing travel books now, 45 years later. His most recent one came out last year. It was called To a Mountain in Tibet. He has this gloriously deep approach to the history of a region that he's travelling through. And he's not afraid to write in a very grandiose style, which suits his type of books.
Good, I want to read every one of those things. Let me ask you just this. What's next?
Well, at the moment, I'm writing a few essays and I've started reviewing for The Guardian, so it's taken up a lot of my time. Because I'm a doctor half the time, I don't have a lot of writing time. But when I do have spare time, I'm working on a book about the Himalayas. 2007, I spent 6 months travelling all around the Himalayas with my wife. So I'm creeping along with that one.
Gavin Francis, everybody. You can find him on his own website, gavinfrancis.com, where he's got reviews, essays, photographs, of course. And don't forget, he's got two excellent books, True North, Travels in Arctic Europe, and of course, Empire Antarctica, Ice, Silence, and Emperor Penguins, both available online or at fine bookstores everywhere. At the end of January, myself and eight other poets had the chance to go to Iraq to be part of the Erbil Literature Festival. And we brought this kind of group together under the auspices of Real Festivals, which will be taking place throughout the UK in March. But basically, the idea of Real Festivals and the reason I was there and helped to organize our involvement in the Erbil Literature Festival is really to bring Scottish poets and authors together with their Iraqi counterparts. And so that's what we did. And through about 4 days worth of workshops and translations, people who kind of were essentially strangers became friends, and they got to know each other's work and each other's lives. The act of translation can be very much like inhabiting somebody else's mind or their skin. You very much get into their lives, and you have to ask questions like, what did you mean, and how did you experience this, and why did you write this? Which is a really, really lovely way to kind of get to know other people in another culture. And that's sort of what we did for the 5-6 days we were in Iraq. We wandered around, we paid attention, we went shopping, and we did normal things. It's obviously a country that has a reputation in the media and the press. But I want to say honestly, we were really welcomed there in Erbil. And more importantly, we kind of realized that people are people no matter what country you're in. And most people are just living their lives, you know? They're selling dates, and they're hanging out and drinking tea, and they're working their jobs, and they're driving taxi cabs and all the normal things that we all do. So it was really wonderful to just see these people kind of get put together. So as a little example of that, I just wanted to share a little taster of what we experienced. So in conversation in this next segment, there's Sabrim Kadim, who's a young Iraqi poet and journalist, and then our friend Christelle Bamford, an emerging writer here in Scotland, albeit with an American accent. And they had worked together on a poem. We're going to have a little taste of that poem, but also a little bit of a conversation conversation about what it's like to be a young female writer living in Iraq. And of course, you're going to hear some Arabic. Sabrine, she's got pretty good English, but when she's dealing with bigger thoughts, our translator, Lauren Piat, was there to help. So you'll hear Lauren's voice as the translation for Sabrine. But both of them, thank you very much to all these people. It was fantastic working with them for 10 days. And we look forward to sharing the whole thing with you in March. I'll give you more details about that after the conversation. Can you tell me a little bit, Sabrine, about what it's like to be a young writer or an emerging writer in Iraq?
الشخص لما يكون شاعرة في العراق أو مع يعني
firstly in terms of the issue of writers emerging and especially for young women writers in Baghdad it's an issue because it's kind of connected to the issue of women in the workplace in general and they face quite a lot of struggles and conflicts within this arena already.
And how do you overcome that? Do you just ignore it, or is there an active way to combat that feeling?
Firstly, I think you need to emphasize on the quality of the writers, and you need to make sure that there are enough women actually writing. And it's not just about speaking about the issue, but actually engaging with it. So it's an issue of the quality of the writers as much as the quantity of the writers.
Is it kind of a responsibility you feel to continue writing and to be, as a woman, is there a responsibility to when you are writing? Is there a different responsibility than young men have, do you think?
Personally, I feel I have a responsibility as a writer, not just as a man or a woman, and I have a certain aim, and that's to finish, to really enact upon it and to finish whatever it is that I want to finish. And it's kind of almost like a kind of personal struggle within me, almost like a kind of wars and conflicts within me, but I feel I need to complete whatever I start. The very existence of women in society and their interaction with society, which is a very male-dominated society, almost gives me a kind of strength and empowers me that I want to engage in it more against all the battles, especially in a society riddled with conflict, both on a kind of social level and on a political level. So the government speaks a lot about human rights and liberalism and rights for women, and yet it doesn't walk the walk, and it's not actually enacting upon that. And so they need to put more effort into actually doing what they say they should be doing.
As a poet, have you found places where you can present your work or be accepted? Have you found some support or networks outside of the government or outside of traditional culture that you can work in, and do you feel satisfied with that, or would you like to see any changes?
Okay.
As a poet, I kind of live outside of the center of kind of the public cultural affairs of things. That kind of stems partly from a kind of personal anxiety. But I was really surprised that I found in the past 3 years that my work is being published and people are starting to talk about me in the more public domain.
And Chris, did you learn anything about just the comparative differences? About did anything like that come up where you were when you were discussing things? Did you learn anything about the way poetry is looked at or how young writers are existing in Iraq versus in Scotland?
Yeah, well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the things that struck me most since coming here. I mean, just in terms of poetry, kind of in the general public, obviously, you know, to some degree, freedom of speech is a problem. You know, I mean, I think that's probably quite obvious. But kind of the depth of knowledge and the passion that, you know, the people we've talked to kind of bring to poetry is astounding. You know, we were doing a panel discussion in the Tea House. You know, we were kind of just batting around ideas, and it was really interesting to hear what everyone was saying, and then they opened it up for a Q&A to the audience. And it was incredible, you know. It was, you know, I just felt like the room must have been kind of packed with poetry professors, because just kind of the depth of knowledge that they displayed, and also just the intensity with which they asked the questions, and they wanted to know the answer. It wasn't out of politeness. And, you know, it's really astounding. I mean, in terms of women writing poetry in Iraq, you know, I've spoken about this with Sabrine, and also we've heard Awazan talk about it. She's the other female poet who's with us on this trip. And, you know, I mean, I'm sure it's just really tough had kind of part and parcel to issues that women face in daily life here. So, and I'm sure it's quite hard to separate that out, but it's great to see, you know, women like Sabrine and Awazan taking part in this, and also just kind of the talent that they show is, you know, incredible. So it's nice just on a purely aesthetic level. It'd be nice to read. But then to kind of also take into consideration the challenges they face in pursuing that, you know, it's amazing.
Would you mind reading a little bit of the poem now? It would be really great to hear. We'll just start with we'll hear a little bit of kind of the end of the poem. And if you want to hear the beginning, you'll have to come to one of our events in Dumfries or Edinburgh or Glasgow.
الحب أن تلمس أطرافي تهبط يداك على شعري تصير عيونك مصابيحي أن تحتجب عن النعاس وتحسب المائدة الظلماء على يوم ممحي من ذاكرة.
And again, love is knowing my fingerprints, your hands in my hair, your eyes lighting my own like lamps in a window, never drawing the shades. It's setting a place for two when you meant to eat alone. It's hanging vines in the garden with votives and feeding each other light like grapes. It's bringing me a dress to dance in, knowing that I only own trousers. It's playing together like children, it's bending to my skinned knee. It's growing me a jonquil. It's the surprise on seeing your face at its center. Love never knocks, nor does it live in our bed. It makes its home in our eyes and shelters me from the wind. It's the silent answer to my silent question. It's sowing me with kisses like seeds. So, has the wick blackened to its end, or was it simply never lit? Are you with me? Are you with me? Don't you dare ask me back. I'm here, clutching my match in the darkness.
We're glad to have you. Thank you both very, very much for talking to us. Thanks very much, Sabrine. Do you want to say anything to the people of Scotland?
I want to see there's another side in Iraq. You see just bums in TV, walking in the street and shopping, and this is our life. We have another side. There's a color you never seen it in TV.
There are pool halls that you can go and play pool in and play cards.
And table tennis.
Sorry. Christelle played a mean game of tennis. There are some pretty good action shots on the Real Festival's website. Thanks to Sabrine and Christelle and, of course, Lauren, who did the translations. I just want to say I love that final sentiment that Sabrine had there. I think she really sums up the whole idea and spirit of Real Festivals, probably in a much more articulate way than I managed to do in the introduction. But if you want to see Christelle and Sabrine, as well as Jen Hadfield, John Glenday, William Letford, as well as their Iraqi counterparts, we're all going to be here in Scotland in March. We're doing a gig at the Bakehouse in Gatehouse of Fleet down near Dumfries on the 19th of March. We're also performing in Edinburgh and Glasgow on the 23rd and 24th of March. Those are at the Scottish Poetry Library and the Poetry Club in Glasgow. Not only is Real Festivals happening in March, March is an epic month for literary events. The Stanza Festival will be happening in St. Andrews, a beautiful poetry festival, which is one of the best in the UK. The events are really, really well curated and is a great way to dip into poetry. Ticket prices are all very reasonable, and they have a wonderful selection of international poets that you're never going to find in one place at one time. Some of the people that we recommend you going to see if you haven't seen the program yet, of course, you've got people like George Surtees, the fantastic Hungarian British poet. You also have people like Liz Lockhead, you know, our Scottish mocker. You have Mark Doty, who's going to be up, who I'm really looking forward to because he's an incredible poet. And we have Luke Wright, who's not only an acclaimed performance poet who travels the world, but also has just got his first collection out, which has been doing very well. The Stanza website, obviously full of information about all the poets that are appearing. If I had to recommend some things to do, if you were going to really just try to be spontaneous and see something new, I'd recommend going to check out Ghost Boy, who's from Australia. He's flying in special for Stanza. He's doing an afternoon session, as are Rachel McCrum and Harry Giles. They're performing in the afternoon. And, you know, make sure to check out one of the Poetry Breakfasts. If you can get up early enough, it's a great way to start your day, and it's a really innovative and interesting thing that Stanza does. Get yourself out of bed and go on the 9th of March, Saturday the 9th of March, and listen to a nice poetic conversation about the natural world and natural engagement. It's a beautiful festival. Truly can't speak highly enough of it. Make sure you get a chance to go into St. Andrews, spend a day or two there. Totally worthwhile. And if you see us, please come and say hi. So that's bookmarked, everybody. I hope you have it bookmarked on your browser. We'll be back next month with more exciting literary chat. But for now, thanks so much to Caro Ramsey, Gavin Francis, Christelle Bamford, Lauren Piat, and Sabrine Karim. We look forward to seeing you all next month. Goodbye for now. Bookmarked is produced by Colin Fraser with music from Ragland.
Thanks for listening to this Scottish Book Trust podcast. Find more book lists, stories, and interview blogs at scottishbooktrust.com and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter.